I guess what we could do is go one by one through those primary sources, but that might be a wee bit formulaic.
In terms of when they were looking at stones and assigning value to them or qualities or virtues of particular stones, were they ever focusing on particular individual stones, saying this diamond has a particular heritage or talismanic power or particular, it's a particularly virtuous one, or is it just diamonds in general?
There's a whole genre of celebrity precious stones which become codified over the period. So for example, Boot is often talking about individual stones which are in the collection of the Holy Roman Empire, the Emperor Rudolf II. And for some of these objects, the most detailed descriptions we have of them are in this natural history text. There are also references to ancient celebrity gemstones. I can't think of particular examples now, but it's a genre which goes all the way back to Pliny. As more and more diamonds arrive in Europe, this becomes more and more. So in the 17th century, a guy called Jean-Baptiste Tavernier goes, he's a French traveller, a merchant and jeweller who goes to India, sells semi-precious stones from Europe and buys up a huge number of diamonds and then sells them to Louis XIV. And several of these are now among the world's most famous diamonds. So the French blue. Anyone heard of the French blue? Or the Regent's diamond? So these are very storied diamonds. The French blue was actually discovered by Tavernier and brought and sold to Louis XIV. And then it was lost during the French Revolution. Then it popped up in the possession of an Anglo-Dutch banker early in the 19th century. But no one knew it was the same diamond because it had been recut in the meantime. So you have to do a lot of detective work to work out whether it really was the original diamond. And even if you can identify it as the original French blue, it's not hard to know what the it's not easy to know what the original French blue actually looked like. So you have to do a quite complicated reconstruction. Anyway, that's a bit further afield. But yes, there's certainly a big genre of celebrity gemstones. So what really interests me is that a lot of these texts are a mixture. On the one hand, these fantastic, symbolic precious stones, which generate these really strong associations between certain gems and certain places in the world. So if you read 17th century travel narratives, you're going to come away with an association between India and diamonds, and between Persia and turquoise, and between the Far East and rubies and sapphire. So that, I mean, it kind of strikes you immediately as you're reading them. So there's a symbolic force behind them, but at the same time, this really precise knowledge of the weights of these objects, the differences of hardness, this connoisseurship of bits of gravel, as I mentioned, but also ability to distinguish between gems which have come from different mines. So this amazing mixture of symbolism and precision, which makes them really interesting to read.
One of the interesting things I was in the reading was the reference to carbuncles, because if you read about, say, the Renaissance period, they talk about carbuncle and marring it. Because it's a huge precious stone, but I don't know why it was called that, because a carbuncle can be something else as well, but and it was in use a lot at the time, and there was great admiration for a large stone, whatever it was. It could be a diamond or a ruby or whatever. But
so it had to be over a certain weight to be called a carbuncle, did it?
Well, I presume so. I don't know.
the lesson I get from reading these natural history texts is that a carbuncle is a big ruby that glows in the dark.
Yes.
Carbuncle, I don't know the etymology exactly, but comes from a Latin word which means fiery or something. So what does Pliny say?
Carbuncle.
The first rank among red gemstones is held by the carbunculi, so-called because of their fiery appearance. The great thing about the carbuncle is it's one of those myths which actually turns out to be true. So there's a strange kind of pendulum shift in these natural history texts. So in the 16th century, which is a kind of credulous century when people can believe anything, well, there's so much new information coming in, and so much of it is totally out of the ordinary. Who would have thought that there's such a thing as a pineapple or such a thing as an armadillo? If there can be, a pineapple, surely there can be a glow-in-the-dark ruby. By the early 18th century, people are kind of a bit more sceptical, so they're suspicious about miracles, they're suspicious about Eastern knowledge. Anything that doesn't fit into some rigorous system is kind of dismissed. But then over the course of the 18th century, people start doing experiments, and they realise, people like Charles Dufay, you know, doing these experiments on diamonds and rubies owned by the Duke, he realises that many precious stones actually do glow in the dark under certain circumstances. So these myths, which were dismissed for 150 years, many of them actually were probably true.
And the other thing that I was going to ask you about, you mentioned the herbarium.
Yeah.
But the monks had a herbarium, didn't they, further back? But that wasn't purely plants for medicinal purposes, was it?
By herbaria, do you mean the pressed plants?
No, this was growing plants, what they called them.
That's right. Yeah, I don't know as much about those. I guess that's different from a botanical garden. I think Ogilvy's point is that the botanical gardens are then described in these books. Mm. They're described in natural history books. Mm. And they're not just for medicinal herbs. They start to become more general. Mm. And you see that as a more general phenomenon over the course of the 16th century in botany. This is another reason why it's when botany was invented, because before that, botany is really the natural history of medical plants. Mm. That's where it comes from. Mm. Whereas in the 16th century, it becomes the natural history of all plants. Yeah. Mm. It kind of escapes from those practical roots. But again, it's one of those examples of the two-faced nature of the Renaissance, because much of this is being driven. I mean, the herbaria and the botanical gardens, these are driven by universities. And the reason the universities are interested in these objects is because they teach medicine. That's why they're interested. Mm.
When did pharmacists stop being a guild then and become a university?
I guess when the guilds were abolished, end of the 18th century. Yeah.
And what's the difference between a pharmacist and an apothecary?
I think they're the same thing. It's just different names. I think apothecary is the 18th century English name and the French name, apothecaire. Whereas, have I come across the word pharmacy? I'm not a historian of medicine, you see, so... If we had one of our stories of medicine, they'd be able to tell you how the word pharmacy was used in the period. People talk about pharmacopoeia. A pharmacopoeia is the Latin word for a book giving a list of medicines. So both words are around apothecary and pharmacopoeia.
Can you say why the difference between Oriental and Occidental mineralogy matters?
Why it matters for us today, or
why it mattered for them? Does it matter for us?
Why did it matter for them? I think the basic reason is that so many precious gems came from the Orient rather than the Occident. That's the basic answer. So it seemed natural to distinguish between the Oriental and Occidental ones. The other point is that, as you might have seen from the Pliny reading, the easiest way to classify gems is based on where they come from.
Okay.
So you might know nothing about the chemical differences between two diamonds, but it's not that hard to know where they came from. Mm. Not totally easy, because you need to think about the trading routes and to trace it back to its origin. But at least you can... you're likely to learn about the origin if you are buying this object from a trader. They're going to tell you something about the origin, even if they can't tell you anything about the chemical composition. So in so far as Pliny classifies gems, he classifies them by where they came from. It's a geographical classification. Mm. Which means that this distinction between Oriental and Occidental is not just a handy contrast. It's at the heart of any gem classification, because geography is at the heart of any gem classification. But I think it's also important because it maps on to this distinction between hard stones and soft stones. So I guess the best way of putting this is that when Awi, insofar as Awi, so I've told you about the official Awi, but there's an unofficial Awi. So if you go to the Museum of Natural History in Paris and you ask very nicely to the archivist there, he will show you a catalogue from the early 19th century, which we think is Awi's catalogue of his private collection. There are two parts of the catalogue. There's the official scientific part, where his classification is like the one I showed you. So it's a classification of his own stones. And there's a second one, which is precious stones. So he has no place for this category in his mineralogy, but he nevertheless has his own precious stone collection, and he's very certain that this is a coherent collection of pierres précieuses. The way that makes its way into the official Awi is that when he talks about corundum, this group of stones which are ruby, sapphire, and topaz, he calls them pierres orientales. That's his name for them. The more general point is that the distinction between Oriental and Occidental becomes essentially the distinction between stones which are made up of corundum and stones which are made up of rock crystal. Basically, that's my summary of a complicated story. So in a certain way, this distinction looks naive and quite simple, but it's kind of prefiguring this more sophisticated distinction that chemists would come up with. It's not that in the 16th century people know about the chemistry, it's that they have noticed something about the differences between these stones, which is actually quite deep, which is related to the differences between their chemical properties. That's what I find really fascinating about that Oriental-Occidental distinction. It looks like a superficial distinction, but actually it's a really deep one.
Because it does reflect the chemical composition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It looks like something which has come from humans, but actually it points to something which has come from nature.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was a bit surprised with anthracite, which was mentioned earlier.
Yes.
Anthracite, I know nothing about anthracite.
Well, I knew you
should put it on our boil. Okay.
I think it came in the list of.
It came at the bottom the map. On the page.
Yeah. It also came in the list of things that, you know, magic things that different things could do. Anthracite was capable of one of these.
This one.
There's a stone called anthracite, and then it goes on to.
Oh, another. Well done.
Mm. Then it goes on to another reading.
Is that Pliny?
This is
Oh, you must. Yeah, you must have been so frustrated because.
Yes, absolutely. Because anthracite is just stuff we used to put up an olive oil for.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was sort of formed out of coal dust briquettes or something.
It was certainly an inexpensive.
Because
we had it.
Maybe they just used the same name to pop when they made these briquette things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or was it Blinders different?
Maybe it's one of the combustible ones anyway.
Yeah. Mm. Mm. Well, they're all carbon, aren't they?
Yeah, more or less. Carbon and... Well, they're all organic, I guess.
Mm. Was amber considered precious, you know, when you see the insects inside them as they are now?
Yeah, so amber's a good test case for the meaning of precious, because sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. Mm. So if you look at... Boot, he says it's not precious because it's not used in gold or silver rings. Mm. It might be used in other kinds of rings, but you're not going to waste a piece of good gold and silver on a piece of amber. Instead, you're going to set a ruby or a sapphire or a diamond into it, at least according to Boot. Yeah.
And it's very fragile as well, isn't it?
Is it?
I might have been told that, but also somebody actually from Amsterdam gave my daughter an amber ring. Mm. When she was, I think, 18, and she was trying something on in a changing room, and her arm sort of slipped and hit the plastic, and it just shattered.
I love that kind of example because it comes up a lot in 17th century texts. So Robert Boyle is this. I'm not sure if you've heard of Robert Boyle, this leading English chemist. You know, the guy who invented English chemistry. He writes a book called On the Origin and Virtues of Gems. He's really interested in precious stones. Mm-hmm. He's a good example for my thesis that scientists love precious stones in this period. But a lot of his information about gems comes from talking to people who happen to wear gems, who are quite observant about these objects. They're very precious. You want to know what's going on with your diamond or your ruby. And he gets really detailed information from, for example, his sister, who is called Catherine Rich. And Boyle is interested in variations in the brilliance of a diamond. How does the brilliance of a diamond change from one day to the next? Mm-hmm. And he's chatting with his sister, who tells him that she has a diamond, which does vary like this. Boyle then says, well, maybe it's just the weather, maybe it's just the temperature or the climate. And she says, no, I've checked. It is not the temperature or the climate. And Boyle loves this because he's a mechanical philosopher. He thinks that everything can be explained in terms of matter and motion. and what this shows to him is that inside the diamond, there is lots of activity. There's lots of internal motion. And so it's not anything from outside the diamond which is causing the change in brilliance, but this internal activity. So he has this amazing vision of precious stones as these pockets of restless activity. rubies and diamonds and emeralds, they're constantly in motion.
And yet they're very hard when you come to them.
That's why he uses this example, because he says... If diamonds are constantly in motion, then everything must be.
How do pearls fit into this scheme? Because they're grown, aren't they? Yeah. They're not
so simple, isn't it?
So
it's not carbon.
They're organic.
That's right. So how do?
Why do they figure that?
Do you think so?
Because you've got carbon in your bones, haven't you?
I don't know. I assume it's organic material which comes from oysters.
Yeah.
So and they were known to come from oysters.
Yes.
In this period. But there was a question about whether they were minerals or plants. So they might be a kind of shell constructed by an organic thing which is actually inorganic. in the same way that humans construct.
Our bones are sort of inorganic, aren't they?
Mm. What are bones made up of? I'm not sure.
Calcium,
but lots of other stuff.
Something ancient.
Presumably, they're all organic molecules in there as well.
But because you can't actually see, you can't look into a pearl. All you've got is the outer gleam of the pearl. Mm. How would they see that as a something of value? Or because you haven't got all these lights and these colours attaching to it.
He had it down as transparent, didn't he?
Transparent in colours. It's the iridescence of it.
Mm. Oh, it's the iridescence.
The fact that it's firstly, it's got this lovely milky white colour, but also it's kind of shimmery. If it's a good pearl, then it appears to have all the colours of the rainbow, like an opal. That's another interesting matter, the fact that opal gets devalued over the course of this period. So Boots thinks opal is great. It's one of his super but if you read a similar text written by a French goldsmith from the 17th century, opal has dropped out. It's dropped down the list. So has emerald. Topaz has gone up the list. And the reason is that topaz is hard, whereas emerald and opal are quite soft. And this is written by someone who cuts stones for a living. So for him, it's hardness that matters. Yes. What he says is the hardness of a stone which determines how shiny it's going to be.
So it's the aesthetics of the stone rather than the colour or the value of it. It's how you can cut it, how you can make it shine.
But it depends on the individual. And the irony is that the people cutting them, who you might think would be worried about the aesthetics, they're the ones who are less worried about the iridescence. They're worried about the hardness. Because for them, that's the key to the quality of the stone.
And what is beryl?
Beryl, I think chemically, beryl is the same thing as emerald. I don't know what the chemical properties of beryl. Where are we?
It's in yellow.
So Boots thinks it's a yellow. It's an object which is small, hard, rare, and beautiful, and which is transparent and coloured, and which happens to be coloured yellow. Okay. That's what it is.
That's great. I got it.
Well, that's a complicated set. So. Boots had great trouble with his colours. At the same time, he was also a good draftsman, and he was creating an album of plants which had been collected, I think were part of the imperial collection. So he was also mixing pigments to draw these plants. So he was very knowledgeable about pigments, and he uses this knowledge to describe the colours of the different gems. So I'm pretty sure that Boots was sensitive to the nuances of colour. So he realises that these are slightly different colours. But the way he uses this is to say that they're inferior. So ruby is at the top of the list of red stones because it has the purest red. And the other ones have slightly purer shades of red. So that's a third level to his classification scheme.
Can I just ask, please, where's alabaster?
Where is alabaster?
Mm.
So, which page?
Yeah, I was worried about this. You might ask me questions about the location of all these places. Caria, alabaster, Great Carthage.
Alabaster and Orpheus are roughly 40 and 60 miles east of Miletus, respectively.
Yeah.
Well, some of them are on the map, aren't they? Because I found...
Did you find it?
Yes, you found it on the map. Yeah, but I don't think you'll find alabaster on the map.
No.
I'm sure that I knew this at some point when I was doing my research. The problem is that it's tricky because the meanings of these names change over time.
Yes.
How are you spelling it, Maureen?
A L A B A N D A.
A L A B A N D A. I love lavender.
Do you think there are any gems we haven't discovered yet?
Any gems we haven't discovered yet?
You think?
There are certainly varieties of gems that we haven't discovered yet. So there's recently been a new variety of opal discovered, which has different properties than the other types of opal. Because I mean, we think of these as species, but they're actually a collection of deposits, which depend on the geographical, geological properties of that particular place. So every opal mine is going to give you a different kind of opal. Every diamond mine is going to give you a different, slightly different sort of diamonds, which is something that someone like Tavernier knew, this French jeweller who's travelling to India. And he's travelling to lots of different diamond mines and noticing differences between them, because he has to buy the best diamonds. So he needs to know which are the best mines. And he noticed all these really subtle differences, like diamonds from some mines come with a green crust around them. Diamonds from other mines, they look very hard, but if you try to cut them on a wheel, they will shatter. Mm-hmm. Other ones, he can tell just by looking at them that they will polish up really well by looking at the raw diamond.
Mm-hmm. You get black diamonds, don't you? They didn't seem to mention them ever.
I have never come across a reference to a black diamond.
But they are, I know, aren't they?
Yeah, you see pieces of jewellery now with black diamonds in.
I wasn't quite sure in the readings whether people thought all these precious stones came from India because that's where they came from as part of the trade route, or whether they were sourced in India.
Yeah, they were sourced in India. And I'm pretty sure they're still sourced in India. Yeah. There's still a big cutting industry in India. It was switched to London and Antwerp and Amsterdam for several centuries, so... between about 1600s and 1900s, most Indian diamonds were cut in Europe and then sent back to India. But then a group of Indian people went to Antwerp and acquired the skills, and some Antwerp cutters went to India. So now there's a really thriving.
That's all in Gujarat, isn't it?
Pardon?
It's all in Gujarat, isn't it?
It's all in Gujarat, is it? I suppose it was just something shiny. There's a bit about putting foil underneath stones to make them look better.
Yeah.
And I thought, where did they get their foil from?
maybe it was gold leaf.
Did they just have something rather shiny?
No, they have a... Well, that comes up in the... It certainly comes up in the Boot book. And he's got this from a whole genre which I didn't talk about, which is called the Books of Secrets of the 16th century. Don't you want to know what a secret is about? A Book of Secrets is a collection of basically craft recipes for doing all sorts of useful things, from making makeup to turning base metals into gold to projecting an image onto a screen to... ensuring that your spouse doesn't talk during their sleep. There's a recipe for this. The secret is to grind up the tongues of geese and feed this to your spouse. No, I got that wrong. That's a recipe for causing your partner to talk more if you have a very quiet and you want them to be a bit more garrulous and social occasion. Grind up goose tongues. Well, geese are an animal who talk a lot.
Yes.
That's magic. It's essentially magic. But these books of secrets also talk about how to enhance gems and how to fabricate gems. And the one that I remember, the recipe I remember, is that you take colourful feathers, say a parrot's feathers, and you burn them and they produce a coloured smoke, and you then hold a piece of metal, whether it's brass or silver or gold or tin, above that smoke, and the foil is the metal is coloured by the smoke. So, and you place it under the diamond in the rain, ideally so that you can't actually tell that it's there. Well, you're more likely to place a coloured one underneath something like a ruby, so a dull ruby, one to enhance it a bit. Or underneath a piece of rock crystal, which you've coloured red, and you want to sell it as a ruby, going to make it even more convincing by putting the foil underneath it.
Parrot fashion.
Sounds like it happens now, doesn't it? All that more sophisticated scale.
We can make diamonds at Warwick.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's a machine in the engineering department which can make a diamond in a couple of hours.
Good. Gosh, I got it
to the
heart
of the earth. That's the thing, pressure and temperature. Yeah.
Where does the word carrot come from? You know, you assess a diamond in so many carrots. Does that go back to Renaissance?
They're certainly using it in these texts. I'm not sure what the origin of it is.
Fascinating, isn't it?
Well, I was just reading one text from the 17th century which reckons it's from an Indian term, or a Persian term, which I think is Quilant, which appears in one of these texts. But I don't actually know where it comes from.
So was your PhD thesis on gems, or is all this research sort of a byproduct of something else that you were concentrating on?
It's a byproduct, but it's now my main thing. So the PhD research was on Charles Dufay and electricity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, I've decided that precious stones sell much better. 18th century electrical theory. Sorry, shifters.
Are there a lot of people studying stones?
Not very many, no. There are a lot of historians of natural history, but for some reason they're attracted to plants and animals and not to minerals. Yes. Minerals are seen as dead and not very interesting. Whereas I think in some ways they're much more interesting.
The impact they've had. Monetary value.
And also the fact that there aren't very many of them.
And cultural importance too. Yes. It's not just...
And how were they mined back then? You know, how did the men who did they go down hundreds of feet to mine these gems, or and how did they achieve that? It must have been, it's grim enough now, but goodness me, what must it have been like? So the social aspect of.
Yeah, we know quite
these things out of the ground.
We know quite a bit about that because of people like Tavernier, who described it in quite a bit of detail, especially the diamond mines in India. So most of them are quite shallow, but then they're nevertheless some of them are actually surface mining. So you just need to find the right location in the river. But some of them are. A genuine hole in the ground. I say we know a lot about them, it doesn't mean I know a lot about them. But it wasn't so much the physical conditions but the social conditions which were difficult. So there was a death penalty for smuggling out a diamond from Indian mines. The best mines go automatically to the local king of the who presides over the mine, at least in most parts of it.
And would he pay? He wouldn't pay for them. Am I being naive in saying that?
No, he owns them.
Right, okay.
And then that makes me think of the whole political controversy around blood diamonds and things. That's another whole area that they're very intricately involved.
Did the India Company take their slice?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. That's why in the 17th century the cutting industry shifts to London, or a large part of the cutting industry, and to Birmingham. Who was I talking to about? Yeah, the Birmingham jewelry. I'm not sure if they've ever cut.
I don't know. I mean, I've lived
in Belgium and Antwerp. They were pretty big diamond based.
Yeah, certainly.
And they don't. They're not. Specialist in settings, it is the diamond. They'll make it up for you very quickly.
Yeah.
But it's the diamond that matters, not the setting or the aesthetic of what we're in. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, the East India Company is very interested. When I say East India Company, I mean especially a major official of the East India Company who can make a lot of money by smuggling diamonds. That's the other great thing of about diamonds. They're concentrated value, so they're easy to transport.
Yeah.
I remember when we lived in Brussels and we used to be invited to a dinner somewhere at some sort of kind of modern day guild, if you like, an association, and a lot of people there had interests in Africa, and it makes me think not much has changed, because I remember at the time seeing, you know, women with watches surrounded in diamonds and you know, makes you think, really.
Plus ça change.
Well, I guess that's one of the problems that the synthetic diamonds are supposed to solve. On the other hand, would you really want a diamond which has been made in the lab at the University of Warwick and took hours?
Not
that
you paid a lot for it being told it was real.
But presumably it costs so much to make one diamond, it's not worth it. Otherwise, Warwick being the commercial university.
De Beers is already selling synthetic diamonds.
How do they make it?
How do you know the difference?
Well, De Beers are very careful about this. They have a careful labelling scheme. They're also, I think, trying to introduce their own signature scheme so that they imprint a kind of label on their own diamonds, a sort of chemical label, so that they can trace them and to help solve the blood diamond issue. So that, assuming you trust De Beers, if you know you've got a De Beers diamond, if it has the De Beers signature, then... But I think they've done something similar with their synthetic diamonds. So De Beers engineers can tell the difference between a synthetic De Beers and a real diamond. I think the synthetic ones are just perfect, whereas the real ones have defects. But eventually they'll find a way to introduce defects into them.
Are synthetic ones cheaper than the real ones? And what's the point of De Beers selling synthetic ones?
They'll be cheaper, won't they?
I guess in the long term, the idea is that they'll be, they'll be cheaper for De Beers to source, I imagine.
But they'll undermine the overall price of diamonds.
That's why De Beers needs to have a good certification and labelling scheme. That's the other thing that interests me about the history of precious stones. That the science of precious stones is often about the identification, not the making them, but identifying them and certifying them. And, of course, the ability to certify them also carries its own economic value, because if only De Beers is able to tell the difference between the real and the fake, then you want that De Beers expertise.
Presumably companies like De Beers, though, can control the market to some extent as well, don't they? Supply.
Yeah.
The illicit market.
And in large part because it's such an enormous conglomerate, I think it's not as big as it was, but in its heyday, it controlled most parts of the commodity chain. So it owned the mines, but it also owned the merchant companies that were selling diamonds. So it had a virtual monopoly over most parts of the industry.
It's called after the name of the farmer whose field they bought.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
He was nobody's special.
Boer is farmer, isn't it? I always wondered if it was from De Boer.
He was a guy called
De Beers.
De Beers, who owned a field in what's now Kimberley.
Yeah, your name is up.
Yeah. Well, that's a stroke of luck, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll have to head away.
Thank you very much.
That's really interesting.